Revelation of a God.
Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, thank you for joining us for the Sunday, April 21st, Colorado Springs Gazette, read by Mary Carley. We begin with the following articles. Schools, teachers, students adapt to security realities, by Nicole Brambio and Kyle Pierce. Water conflict, by Mary Shin. Fifth Congressional District Candidates Talk, by Brianna Gent. And Colorado College Surviving Roaring Twenties and World War II, by Tom Cronin and Bob Levy. Additional articles will follow. Schools, teachers, students adapt to security realities. What happened at Columbine High School 25 years ago was not the first or the last mass shooting at a school in America, but it was the first covered in a 24-hour news cycle, and it remains deeply ingrained in the American psyche. The tragedy prompted a national debate on guns and mental health and unprecedented change to school security. I loved Columbine, said Frank DeAngelis, the former principal of Columbine High School. It was like my second family. Then, April 20th, 1999 came, a day in which my life changed forever. And not only my life, I think it changed the country and the world. DeAngelis retired in 2014 from Jefferson County Public Schools after 30 years, 18 of which he was principal at Columbine, including that fateful day. He now helps others work through the trauma similar to what he experienced at Columbine. On April 22, two students killed 12 schoolmates and a teacher, and injured 21 before taking their lives. The tragedy shattered the belief that children were safe at school, and it upended the way enforcement responds to active shooters. It was a pivotal moment on how law enforcement responds to these things, said Denver Public Schools Chief of Safety Greg Kazel. We no longer wait, Kazel added. That started changing the response. Before Columbine, there wasn't a standard response for active shooter situations. The only drills we did back in 1999 were fire drills, DeAngelis said. In the wake of the shooting, law enforcement's response underwent significant changes. Gone were the days of negotiating with the shooter or waiting for a SWAT team to respond. School districts and law enforcement agencies across the nation began developing active shooter protocols that emphasized an aggressive, swift response to neutralize the threat. But as the shootings in Parkland, Florida, and Uvalde, Texas have shown, the response by officers doesn't always follow what the protocols outlined. In 2018, Scott Peterson, a former school resource officer, stayed outside while Nicholas Cruz killed 17 staff and students at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. A jury acquitted Peterson last year, effectively absolving him of wrongdoing. 2 years ago in Uvalde, police officers waited more than an hour before breaching a classroom as Salvador Ramos, a former Robb Elementary School student, gunned down 19 kids and two teachers. That goes against what we learned at Columbine, Kazel said. Jefferson County Chief of Schools David Weiss and Kazel, as undoubtedly school officials across the nation do, scour the reports that follow a shooting to glean what they can learn from the missteps. None of us want a tragic event to happen, but the worst thing that we can do is not be prepared, Weiss said. Part of being prepared, Weissenkassel argued, is bringing the lesson learned from other shootings back to the team. Each of the incidents, I think, we learn from and try to do better, Weiss said. There have been 404 school shootings between Columbine and April, according to the Washington Post, which said it pieced together data from news articles, reports from law enforcement, open source databases, and calls to schools and police departments. Some of those shootings didn't involve injury. The federal government doesn't keep numbers on school shootings. The frequency of school shootings nationally appears to be increasing, according to the Washington Post database. It's hard to say if we're safer now than we were before, said Rob Gould, president of the Denver Classroom Teachers Association. But I'd probably say no. The teachers' union represents 4,000 educators throughout Denver public schools. That's roughly about 70% of the district's teachers. School resource officers have long been touted as one of the answers to increased security concerns on campus. But school resource officers didn't emerge in response to Columbine. The practice actually started in the 1950s. Some maintained it was meant to improve the relationship between local police officers and youth, while others assigned more explicit racial underpinnings. In any case, school resource officer programs gained popularity in the aftermath of school shootings in the 1990s, specifically those in Columbine and Jonesboro, Arkansas. And their presence has grown exponentially since then, paid for in part with federal funding allocated in response to school shootings. In 2020, the U.S. had roughly 23,400 sworn officers in schools across the nation, according to the U.S. Justice Department. Denver Public Schools was among a string of school districts across the nation that removed SROs from campuses following the killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer 4 years ago and the national protests that ensued. Last year, a student at East High School shot two administrators, and under pressure to respond, the Denver Public School Board reversed its 2020 decision and voted to return SROs to Denver schools. School resource officers are sworn peace officers who work in a school setting. Colorado has 300 SROs for its 1,900 school buildings. While parents in Denver clamored for more police presence in the aftermath of the shooting at the district's flagship school, teachers largely believed other strategies could be more effective. What would make teachers feel safer? A Denver Classroom Teacher Association survey last year said, it wasn't necessarily metal detectors, cameras, or SROs. Instead, the educators expressed overwhelming support for smaller class size and caseloads and a full complement of student mental health supports to feel safe in schools, the survey said. Smaller class size means teachers have more time getting to know their students better and their personal struggles in order to address needs and close learning gaps, the survey suggested. That's about being able to check in with all of your students, Gould said. Kassel agreed. It comes down to our students and knowing when they're in crisis. Brooklyn Madden vividly recalls her first lockdown 2 years ago and her wide-eyed students who wondered whether it was a drill. Following protocols, she shut out the lights, locked the door, corralled 30 fourth graders, and then steeled herself to assume a role Madden, then a first-year teacher, hoped she'd never have to play. Protector. I was terrified, said Madden, noting how the weight of that responsibility became real in that moment. I thought, I don't know what I signed myself up for. Madden teaches at Mountain Phoenix Community School in Wheat Ridge. While the school lockdown that day turned out to be a false alarm, Madden knew what to do because of the active shooter training that wasn't available 2 decades ago. The active shooter drills, though, might have its own costs, some say. Lori Fernald harbors fear all the time about shooters. She hopes she'll remember her training. She worries whether she can run fast enough to lock the door and whether she'll be brave enough. Fernald, who's now a substitute teacher in Lakewood, began teaching a decade before the Columbine shooting. She never dreamed becoming a teacher would require she learn lockdown drills. When she started in the classroom in 1988, the only drills teachers conducted at the time were fire drills. "I expected to have to keep kids safe, like teachers do," Fernald said, "but not from shootings. You know, don't run with scissors. Don't jump off the top of the slide. I never thought about someone coming and shooting kids. Never, ever. That never crossed my mind as something that could happen in a classroom." Fernald also worries about the long-term impact it will have on her students, who often chant during recess after a lockdown drill. "Locks, lights, out of sight," they say while they play. "I had a student once tell me, I don't think about if there's going to be a lockdown and if there's going to be an active shooter. I think about when it's going to happen." I think we underestimate the negative impact this kind of environment has on our students. School leaders and those in law enforcement insist there's not a single solution to America's gun violence. That's why they said the safest campuses employ a variety of security layers to get ahead of the threat. It includes badges and locked doors, secure vestibules that provide administrators control over who can enter, security cameras, school resource officers, and Safe to Tell Colorado, an anonymous way for students and staff to report safety concerns. "There just isn't one thing that's going to stop it," DeAngelis concluded. Water conflict. Colorado Springs Utilities, others say that Aurora is in violation of the 03 agreement. A Colorado water district spanning 9 southeastern counties believes Aurora Water is violating a 2003 agreement not to purchase more Arkansas Valley Basin water. Aurora Water is spending $80 million on a ranch of 5,000 acres near Rocky Ford and its associated water rights. An Aurora presentation showed it estimates it's paying $9,600 per acre foot of water. The purchase could yield 18,000 to 22,500 acre feet every 10 years. Aurora City documentation states, "An acre foot of water can serve 4 families for a year in Colorado Springs. Aurora Water expects to use the water 3 out of every 10 years to help support its growth and allow the water to irrigate crops during the remaining 7 years. Aurora residents would not see additional rate increases outside of those planned," said Alex Davis, an assistant general manager for the utility who works on water supply and demand. "Providing drinking water for the future of Aurora is really important. Water supplies are getting more and more difficult to ensure for the future." Aurora and Colorado Springs Utilities have looked to the Arkansas Valley for water to support growth in recent years, and farmers have faced dry conditions. In this case, Aurora is facing opposition to its purchase from water districts in the valley and utilities. Southeastern Colorado Water Conservancy District President Bill Long said the purchase breaks an agreement Aurora Water signed with the district. Residents in the district have said property taxes to support bringing water from the western slope to the Arkansas Basin. They've purchased water when they agreed not to, he said. Utilities said in an official statement they agree with the Southeastern Colorado Water Conservancy District's interpretation that the purchase is in violation of the 2003 agreement. As signatory to the Arkansas River Basin Preservation Principles, we oppose permanent out-of-basin transfers from an already water-short basin, the statement said. The 2000 agreement was reached after Aurora made large purchases of water in Crowley and Otero counties in a practice known as buy and dry, where the water leaves the land forever. Under its agreement with Southeastern Aurora, agreed to only lease water from farmers and a series of other conditions. Davis, on behalf of Aurora, disagrees with Southeastern's interpretation. She said Aurora agreed not to buy water and permanently move it out of the Arkansas Basin, and that Aurora does not plan to permanently move the water. Aurora has committed to keeping the land in production. Aurora also tried to lease water from farmers, but found the timing of such arrangements tough. The utility can only move water out of the basin when its reservoirs are 60% full or less, and naturally, those are more dry times. The water provider found farmers were not interested in leasing at those times because prices were higher for crops. The purchase gives Aurora more control and certainty, she said. Long argues the community will see economic losses in the years when the water isn't available and the farmland is fallowed. While the Southeastern Colorado Water Conservancy District could take Aurora Water to court over the purchase, that's not the district's goal. I personally told Aurora Water General Manager Marshall Brown we were willing to sit down and have a conversation about these issues, he said. Davis said Aurora would be open to agreement that formalizes its commitment not to permanently move the water out of the basin, and otherwise working through issues with the district and others that oppose the deal, including the Lower Arkansas Valley Water Conservancy District. The Lower Arkansas Valley District also has an agreement with Aurora Water that required the utility to offer to lease water to others before leasing it to themselves, said Peter Goebel, the general manager of the district. He would like to see some financial mitigation for the community. As part of a recent deal to buy water along Arkansas Valley, utilities agreed to direct annual payment to Bent County of $45 per acre of water to help offset the losses, Long said. Bent County producers plan to use the funds from the purchase to buy center pivot irrigation systems and sell utilities water that will be saved as part of the conversion from flood irrigation. As part of the conversion, irrigators will no longer water the corners of their fields because center pivots rotate in a circle. The corners represent 22% of the fields. The deal that Colorado Springs Utilities just made with Bent County is far superior, Long said. In general, Goebel said he'd prefer the city's lease water rather than buy it to provide economic support to Arkansas Valley farmers. It's way better for the Lower Valley if they're selling them the milk rather than selling them the cow, he said. Fifth congressional district candidates talk veteran health care, Space Command, and more. Veteran health care, Space Command, and foreign affairs were some of the hot topics last week for six candidates hoping to next represent the El Paso County-based 5th Congressional District. 100 people crowded the Mount Carmel Veterans Services Center, where there was standing room only to hear the candidates speak on issues important to the local veteran and military communities at a forum moderated by Gazette News partner KOAA. Veterans, local elected leaders, and other community members attended. Congressional hopefuls seeing to replace longtime U.S. Representative Doug Lamborn, a Republican, in the seat were Republicans Jeff Crank and Colorado Republican Party Chair David Williams, Democratic River Gassman, and Joe Reagan, and third-party candidate Christopher Michael. Constitutional Party and Katrina Nguyen, Independent. Over 90 minutes Thursday, they spoke on several issues and shared their vision for the district, which encompasses much of El Paso County and has elected a Republican since 1972. Highlights included health care. Veterans are waiting months, in some cases, to get health care appointments, and U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs facilities at important all candidate as a problem. Many candidates said cutting barriers to care begins with expanding coverage through privatized or VA provided and community centers. Allowing veterans more choice will improve the backlog and allow veterans and service members to seek treatment from providers they trust. If veterans choose to go outside and get community care, they should get it, said Crank, a podcaster and executive with Koch Network-based Americans for Prosperity. He touted the Bipartisan Mission Act former President Donald Trump signed in 2008 that in part allowed veterans better access and more health care choice at VA or community providers. The VA has consistently thrown up barriers for veterans time and time again. How about letting veterans decide where they want their care, opening up community care, and letting the veteran choose rather than some bureaucratic VA? Congress needs to hold them accountable, Crank said. Reagan, an Army veteran who served two combat tours in Afghanistan, said while community care is an important tool to help reduce appointment wait times, many primary care doctors aren't experienced enough with military patients to ask the right questions. For example, the 2022 PACT Act expanded VA health care and benefits for veterans exposed to toxic substances like burn pits and Agent Orange. A primary health care provider isn't going to ask a normal 42-year-old male like me about prostate cancer. But because I was exposed to toxic substances over in Afghanistan over the course of 2.5 years, that increases my risk. Only a VA provider is going to know to ask that question because it's very specific to my health care and my experience serving in the military, Reagan said. U.S. Space Command. The November election could reignite the years-long debate over where U.S. Space Command should be permanently based. The Air Force decided last summer it will remain in Colorado Springs instead of moving to Huntsville, Alabama. The decision capped more than 2 years of wrangling by Colorado and Alabama officials after Trump announced in the final days of his administration the command's headquarters would move to Alabama. Colorado GOP Chair Williams has said in the past he'd support Space Command's home in Alabama. On Thursday, he said the command belongs in Colorado Springs, but the decision to keep it there was political rather than based on merit. Just because we're a blue state, and just because Joe Biden wants to reward Democrats in Colorado, doesn't mean that we should be sacrificing our principles to keep Space Command here, Williams said. The only candidate on Thursday endorsed by Trump, Williams said he's in the best position to ensure that decision stands, not because of some woke ideology or bad abortion politics, but because we win it on the merits, because we have the highest concentration of military and veteran populations that we can pull from a strong presence. Nguyen, who on her campaign website describes herself as a peacemaker, said she believes unequivocally Space Command belongs in Colorado Springs. Not only do we have lots of the capabilities here, we have a lot of intelligent people here. It belongs here. Our leaders are all united on that. Republicans, Democrats, this is the place for Space Command to be, she said. Foreign aid. Republican U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson is facing growing threats from House members to oust him as he works to advance a $95 billion package that would provide foreign aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, as well as a border security bill. When asked if he'd vote for the proposals in their current form, Colorado Springs-based electrical engineering contractor Mitchell, who ran for the 5th District in 2022 and for Colorado Springs mayor last spring, said he supports aid for Taiwan and Israel, but not for Ukraine. I would decline the aid to Ukraine solely on the basis that we're throwing money down a rabbit hole with no accountability. Ukraine is not a proven ally, Mitchell said. Any supposition that is put out by lawmakers about what Russian President Vladimir Putin may or may not do is just that. It's supposition. So they base funding Ukraine on a supposition without true facts of knowing what's really going to happen. The U.S. has spent more than $44 billion worth of weapons, maintenance, training, and spare parts to Ukraine since Russia invaded the country in February 2022. Gasson, a scientist who has a degree in economics and has worked for the NASA Glenn Research Center, the Space Foundation, and UCCS, said the U.S. has a responsibility to protect Ukraine under the 1994 Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons. Under that treaty, the U.S. promised to protect Ukraine if it was invaded by Russia, since Ukraine agreed to give up its claim to nuclear weapons under the 1993 Budapest Memorandum. We have an obligation to help them because they've done their part, and we need to do ours, Gasson said. I'm willing to spend any dollars necessary to prevent World War III, because this war between Russia and Ukraine could very easily spill over into NATO territory, and I don't want to lose any American soldiers in Europe. Colorado College survived the Roaring Twenties and World War II. May 6th is the 150th anniversary of the first day of teaching classes at Colorado College. Here are some highlights of the college's history during three momentous decades. The arrival of the Roaring Twenties on the Colorado campus brought the fulsome breath of Prohibition and the clanging discords of hot jazz. The quieter college students of earlier days were replaced by young rebels yearning for freedom and self-expression. Women's students' skirts became shorter. From trains sweeping sidewalks to just covering their knees, shorn hair cluttered the floors of beauty parlors as young women wore their hair closely cut. For some students, drinking and smoking became a regular part of campus social life. By the time young people were ready for college, they were apt to have learned not only to condone the hip flask filled with illegal alcohol, but to expect it. And then there was the exuberant arm-waving and leg-waving dance, the Charleston. Celebrations followed football victories and were centered on the women's dormitories. Male students could be heard singing as they marched into the women's dormitory quadrangle. As the men approached on the ground, the women's students clapped their hands in unison from their dorm windows. Sometimes, after big football games, college officials would relax the women's dorm rules and let the female students come out of the dorm after hours and dance with the male students in the women's quad. But the women had to be back in the dorms by 1 a.m. sharp. When football season ended, the students invented the Sunday serenade. On Sunday nights, male students would assemble in the women's quad and try to outdo each other, providing entertainment, playing kettle drums, saxophones, and other instruments. The women would gather on the porches and at the windows of the dorms for the performance. The Sunday serenade could last as long as an hour, with skyrockets, red flares, hula dancing, and blues singing all part of the show. The 1920s and 1930s were years of men's athletic glory at Colorado College. Full tuition, room and board scholarships enabled the college to recruit skilled male athletes and compete on an equal basis with much larger institutions, including the University of Colorado at Boulder and Colorado State University at Fort Collins. The most outstanding Colorado College athlete at the time was Earl Dutch Clark, who played quarterback from 1927 to 1929. A native of Fowler, he became the first All-American football player in Colorado. He went on to a distinguished professional football career with the Detroit Lions and was chosen a charter member of the National Football League Hall of Fame. The Great Depression of the 1930s took a fearsome toll at Colorado College. The stock market crash in 1929 greatly reduced the income from the college endowment. Out-of-town student enrollment dropped so fast that three women's dorms, Montgomery, Tickner, and McGregor Halls, were closed. They weren't reopened until 1937. The college was forced to spend $215,000 from the endowment to get by. Faculty salaries were cut 20%, beginning with the 1933 fall semester. The Broadmoor Hotel decided in 1938 to convert its indoor horseback riding arena into an ice rink. Shortly thereafter, a men's ice hockey team was organized at Colorado College. It wasn't long before the team was playing opponents from across the nation and drawing capacity crowds to the new Broadmoor World Arena. The college was able to support such a first-rate men's ice hockey program by providing athletic scholarships. Colorado College's ice hockey team had some good years over its first few decades. In 1950 and again in 1957, Colorado College won the NCAA Men's Ice Hockey Championship. During World War II, Colorado College continued to operate normally, but in addition, operated a Navy and Marine Corps V-12 officer training program. Youth men Bound for War received military training at the same time they took college-level courses. As a result, many young men who otherwise wouldn't have been able to go to CC were able to matriculate while serving. Over 400 Navy V-12 students at CC were under the direction of two Marine Corps drill instructors, Staff Sergeant John Lilly and Sergeant John Onuska. The men would remain in formations around the campus, learning to march quickly and take orders. The men experienced close order drills, reveille at 6 a.m., beds made before chow, formation in the early morning, and regular inspection of quarters. The V-12 curriculum was heavy on physics and math, including a course in military orientation. Besides being in uniform and under the watchful eyes of Navy and Marine officers and enlisted personnel, life as a college student wasn't materially different for V-12 students. There were college dances, playing cards, socializing at the student union, and college theater. Many former V-12 students who had been officers elected to return to Colorado College instead of attending home state colleges or universities. Many commented about the quality of life and education at CC. 52 Colorado College men, former professors, former students, and V-12 officers lost their lives in World War II. By the time the war ended in 1945, almost 2,000 Navy Marine trainees had participated in Colorado College's V-12 program. In 1946, as Colorado College entered the post-World War II era, enrollment was at an all-time high of 1,250 students. Colorado's Growing Regulatory Burden by Kelly Caulfield. The rising cost of living in Colorado is top of mind for everyone. Whether it's housing, energy, or food, the cost of being a Coloradan is quickly growing out of reach for many. Want to order a pizza? To have it delivered? Now comes with a 27-cent fee before adding the pepperoni. Checking out at the grocery store, the shoe store, or even the hardware store? Expect to pay 10 cents for a bag. Those are small individual changes to be sure, but they add up, particularly when combined with significant increases in other costs, including electricity and property taxes. Colorado businesses face a similar drip of regulatory costs. While some of these costs might be relatively minor when viewed individually, their aggregate impact is a growing burden on our state's businesses. Much of this burden, of course, cascades through the economy to consumers. In 2023, Common Sense Institute released a research study that quantified the cost of the regulatory burden at a staggering $2 billion, imposed by just 20 pieces of legislation and ballot measures in two key policy areas, energy and environment, and labor and employment. In a separate report, it examined how 43 recent bills shifted costs to businesses by creating, expanding, and modifying civil causes of action. A new study written by Common Sense Institute, Mike Laprino, demonstrates that Colorado's regulatory juggernaut continues. The report highlights 24 bills that were introduced in this legislative session, including in the areas of energy and environment, labor and employment, housing and health care. Although the legislative session isn't over, and some of these bills have been or will be defeated or amended, whatever emerges from the session will drive the existing $2 billion figure even higher. The six bills introduced in the area of energy and environment have the potential to dramatically undercut the oil and gas industry in Colorado, with cascading impacts on the state's economy, tax base, schools, and middle-class workers. In the most extreme case, Senate Bill 24-159 would terminate oil and gas well permitting by 2030, effectively consigning the industry to a slow extinction. Other bills in this package would significantly increase regulatory oversight and penalties in ways likely to drive up costs and make compliance more difficult. The stated aims of this legislation include improved air quality, community health and safety, and the protection of vulnerable populations. And these are laudable goals, we can agree. But clarity is needed on the degree to which each of these measures will advance the goals, and the degree to which those improvements justify their direct and indirect costs. Under the banner of housing, three bills regarding contractor liability push costs in opposite directions when it comes to the cost of construction. Senate Bill 24-106 creates a right of repair for contractors to fix problems without costly litigation. Its purpose is to stimulate condo construction by developers that had shunned this work for fear of lawsuits without limiting consumer protections. Conversely, House Bill 24-1008 and House Bill 24-1230 increase contractor liability for wage claims and residential construction defects, respectively, and it's anticipated these costs will be added to housing costs for consumers. A group of proposed bills in the landlord-tenant area likely will shift some costs to landlords, which puts pressure on rents. Those include House Bill 24-1057, prohibiting the use of algorithms for setting rent amounts, House Bill 24-1298, making it more difficult for a landlord to evict a tenant, and House Bill 24-1007, prohibiting local governments from enacting or enforcing certain residential occupancy limits. House Bill 24-1075 wouldn't alter costs because this bill merely authorizes additional analysis, not an implementation of a single-payer healthcare system. While prior cost projections of a single-payer system for Colorado suggested there will be some savings from government-imposed payment rate caps, prior Common Sense Institute work has shown how rate setting in healthcare markets causes costs to shift and access to be diminished. Senate Bill 24-130 increases the cap for recovery of non-economic damage in medical malpractice cases. In an excellent illustration of how legislation that is rejected in 1 year sometimes returns in following sessions, House Bill 24-1014 is a consumer protection measure that seeks to resurrect a reform that failed in the 2023 session. By eliminating the longstanding requirement that a significant number of consumers be harmed before remedies may be available under the Colorado Consumer Protection Act, House Bill 24-1014 expands the number of instances in which businesses can be found to have engaged in deceptive trade practices. When combined with several of the new expanded causes of civil action identified in Common Sense Institute's 2023 report on litigation costs, House Bill 24-1014 has the potential to expose businesses to considerably increased litigation risk. Probably the most concerning characteristic of the proposed regulatory legislation is that very few, if any, of these measures appear to have undergone serious cost-benefit analysis before introduction. As the economist Thomas Sowell famously noted, there are no solutions, just trade-offs. While much, if not all, of the proposed regulations are well-intended, and some might in fact be good policy, the persistent failure to consider secondary consequences is deeply troubling. The proposed regulations increase the price of doing business in Colorado, and when layered on top of existing regulatory costs, make our state less and less affordable and dissuade families and individuals from moving or remaining here. Some might welcome the news that our population is no longer meeting fast-paced growth projections and inward migration appears to have slowed. While that sentiment is probably shared by many when battling traffic or reserving a Memorial Day camping spot, we should nevertheless be concerned when rising costs threaten our competitiveness. Colorado has always depended on inward migration to maintain our first-rate workforce, and we want to remain attractive in the competition for talent. Utilities gets grant to address aging gas service lines by Aggie Suka. Officials with Colorado Springs Utilities announced last week the reception of a $5.2 million grant in part of the National Natural Gas Distribution Infrastructure Safety and Modernization Program to fund the replacement of hundreds of natural gas service lines throughout aging neighborhoods in central Colorado Springs. According to utilities officials, the grant program established in November 2021 by President Joe Biden's bipartisan infrastructure law is intended to reduce safety risk and methane emissions from natural gas distribution pipes. Officials said the grant will fund the replacement of 314 bare steel natural gas service lines throughout a 3.9-mile stretch in central Colorado Springs. Utilities said that while bare steel service lines proved prevalent decades ago, they've become a preference of the past. Evolving technology and practices have proven high-density plastic-based pipes to be much more resilient to underground shifts and leaks. According to utilities, the bare service lines are targeted for replacement from the grant funds, and they're all within older neighborhoods in the central Colorado Springs area. As our community grows and as we continue to diversify our local economy, we must continue to invest in our core infrastructure, the infrastructure we rely upon, said Utilities Board Chair David Donaldson. According to Utilities, 619 bare steel service lines have already been addressed in the utilities service area. Following the lines addressed with the received grant funding, roughly 8,000 bare steel service lines remain on the utility's natural gas distribution system. Utility CEO Travis Steele said the received grant funding will not only increase reliability and safety within the utility's natural gas system, but will also help to reduce rate impacts on utilities customers, some of whom are already struggling with existing economic conditions. As a longtime community-owned for-service utility, this grant funding is essential to building on safety and reliability investments we continue to make in our natural gas system, Deal said. According to utilities spokesperson Steve Barry, work to replace the service lines will begin between the end of 2024 and the beginning of 2025. It's unclear at this time which neighborhoods and roadways will be impacted by the line replacement efforts. U.S. Representative Crow calls for measures to curb gun violence. This doesn't have to be normal, said lawmaker, whose district includes schools where 13 were gunned down, by Ernest Lunning, Colorado Politics. The congressman who represents the neighborhoods surrounding Columbine High School said the 25th anniversary of the shooting that left 13 victims dead at the Jefferson County School should spur lawmakers to do what they can to reduce gun violence. U.S. Representative Jason Crow, an Aurora Democrat, said that the anniversary is a time to honor the victims and renew efforts to enact common sense policy to reduce the dangers posed by firearms, which in 2020 overtook auto accidents as the leading cause of death of children and teenagers in the United States. Prior to Columbine, shootings didn't really happen in America like this. Since 1999, the pace and frequency of these have spun out of control, said Crow. And now it's part of our everyday life. This doesn't have to be normal. The Columbine shooting at the time, the worst school shooting the country had seen, has cast a shadow across the decades, Crow said, changing the way Americans think about schools and child safety. So many of us who grew up in the 1980s and 90s didn't have to grow up doing shooter drills or taking bulletproof backpacks to school or jumping out of seats when a balloon pops at a pep rally, said Crow, who represents the suburban 6th Congressional District. We've now created this societal trauma that all of our children are living with. It's impacting their mental health, their ability to learn, their overall well-being. Students shouldn't be scared to go to school. Gun violence prevention is not a partisan issue. It affects every family in this country, and it's past time now for us to act at a national level. Crow said a bipartisan gun bill passed by Congress in 2022, the first national legislation on guns signed into law this century, marked a step in the right direction, but it wasn't enough. He also lauded the Biden administration for a federal rule announced last week to require background checks on firearm sales at gun shows, closing what advocates have called a loophole that allowed the Columbine shooters to obtain some of their guns. There has been some progress, and even at the state and local level, we're seeing that too, including in Colorado, as we take up the assault weapons ban, Crow said, referring to a bill making its way through the state legislature to ban assault weapons. Crow, a co-sponsor of a federal assault weapons ban, said he supports the Colorado legislation, whose fate remains uncertain after passing the state House and heading to the state Senate. We know it works because we had it on the books for a decade, Crow said. We had a national assault weapons ban from 1994 to 2004. And during that period, shootings using those weapons were down by over a third. He acknowledged that the proposed ban wouldn't bring an end to shootings. Public policies aren't designed to prevent every problem and to fully solve an issue. There's no policy in history that solved all of the problems. It's to reduce greatly the amount of problems and the impact on the community of certain issues, he said, comparing measures seeking gun restrictions to traffic safety laws, which led to steep reductions in motorist deaths after seatbelts were required. In closing, thank you for joining us for the Sunday Colorado Springs Gazette, read by Mary Carley.
AfterSight presents your low vision resource of the day. Today we would like to highlight Health Resource Diabetes Training Camp. This organization provides unique and customized programs and coaching that empower the community of people with diabetes to thrive. Learn more by visiting www.diabetestrainingcamp.com.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777. You're listening to AfterSight.